Welcome to the Money Markets and Masterminds podcast from Citywire South Africa that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment, and strategic decision making. If you're a fund selector or an independent financial advisor looking for insights, analysis, and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place. Here with me, editor Ruan Uester. Today's podcast is all about the latest economic trends and developments that are shaping economies around the world, with a specific focus on sovereign debt and the controversial topic of prescribed assets. Joining us today is Riza Ismail, who's the head of bonds at Prescient Investment Management, who has consistently demonstrated his expertise and strategic acumen in this field. He joined the firm as a portfolio manager in November 2019 and ascended to his current role in February 2021. Welcome, Riza.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be with you guys.
The South African economy has been facing significant challenges in recent years. Structural issues such as high unemployment, inequality, and sluggish growth rates. The COVID-19 pandemic, of course, made it even worse, leading to a contraction in GDP and placing tremendous pressure on the fiscus. One of the key concerns surrounding the South African economy is its rising government debt and the upward trajectory reaching unsustainable levels, which means the servicing costs are growing astronomically, with the country not being able to show much for those increases. So, Riza, how much exactly does South Africa spend on servicing its debt? And will dipping in our foreign reserve in the short term meaningfully alleviate the pressure over the longer term?
Hi, thanks for the question. Yeah, so basically on the first part of the question, so it's about 20% of revenue that is basically allocated to debt service costs. I mean, and that is basically an eye-watering number. In around 2017, 2018, that fiscal window, this number was of the order of about 13%. In other words, 13 cents of every rand goes into servicing debt. That was in around 2017. And that number has now, escalated to around 20 cents in every rand that is going to service debt, right? So, but now if we just look at that question, so obviously it's a concern with the quantum of fiscal revenues that is going into servicing debt. And what is of greater concern perhaps is, whether this number actually stabilizes and even potentially, has scope to almost have a mild little bit of a downtrend, in the outer years. I mean, that now sort of remains to be seen. So, but what is alarming is the run rate or the trajectory, at which this number has escalated, right? So coming now to the question of basically the Treasury's use of, sort of like the GFECRA account, right? So which is essentially a gold and foreign exchange, sort of reserve account, that is held at the central bank, right? So there was quite a lot of, I mean, I think this was the topical issue of the recent budget, right? So the issue was, I mean, was it a prudent move? And what does it really achieve? And I think that we should really sort of just lay out the alternatives that were, on the table for the minister in terms of what really were the levers that he had to pull. So the first one was, could he potentially, in the face of a fiscal deficit, could he, perhaps look at perhaps raising taxes, right? To get the marginal revenue. Now, what we know is that this in the past has not proved to be, a fruitful strategy because of the fact that so much of the tax burden is borne by the upwardly mobile segments of society that, that if they find the tax jurisdiction unfavorable, they will simply pack up shop and move on to a location that is a little bit more, favorable from a taxation perspective. So just simply increasing the tax rate doesn't really get you the desired result. So that's option A, which we can essentially just put a red line through, okay? And then option B was increasing the size of the nominal bond auctions, right? And this was also a very, very unpalatable route to take because, like with anything else, the more supply comes onto the market, the more the price basically dwindles. And in bond terminology, that means you basically are faced with the prospect of higher yields, and even higher, potential future marginal cost of servicing debt, right? So option B on the table, but also we can more or less draw a red line through that one. So that really leaves like very few other options, one of which was essentially tapping into the GFECRA. And I mean, it is, just for clarification, this is the Treasury's own money that is merely held on the account or almost on the balance sheet of the central bank, right? So, I mean, in terms of looking at this thing holistically in the context of the available options at the time, I think it was a prudent move, simply because what it then does is it then allowed the Treasury not to basically increase the size of the weekly bond auctions, which meant that, you know, you have now the prospect of having stronger weekly auctions, having the prospect of not more bonds coming to market, having the prospect of yields clearing at lower and stronger yields, which means that you don't really have this escalation in marginal interest costs, which is exactly what the Treasury sought to avoid. So it now remains to be basically seen whether these funds and how government basically uses these funds that have now been accessed via the GFECRA account, whether that will be used like debt in the past has been merely to service current expenditure, or whether these funds will actually be used to basically get plowed into, for example, infrastructure development or fixed capital formation that will serve as a springboard for growth in the future. So it remains to be seen how prudently the funds are actually deployed. But just on the signaling value alone, I think it was a positive step to actually make use of the GFECRA account.
Reza, our high levels of debt not only pose risk to fiscal sustainability, but also crowd out private and foreign investment. Do you think there will be a dramatic shift in the asset allocation strategies of money managers into our local fixed income sector?
Yes, so I think it's an interesting one. So let me start off with the bond market, which is the area where I sort of ply my trade, right? So, if you look at the South African bond market, I mean, it was sort of widely, in somewhat sensationalist fashion, I mean, it was widely touted that at the time at which we got our final downgrade, from the formal rating agencies, that was around March 2020. It was the same time as the eye of the storm in COVID. I mean, it was widely thought that there would be like a large scale capitulation in terms of the support that the foreign market would afford the South African bond market, let's just say. But I mean, in fact, we did not see this, capitulation for that reason alone. I mean, there were other things that one needs to consider. But the reality, if we take a step back about the South African bond market, is that South Africa has built up a stockpile of credibility, let's just call it, over the years, largely in terms of the credibility of its reserve bank and also the credibility of its sort of judicial institutions and, for the general sort of rule of law. So we've built up a stockpile of credibility along that front, right? So if you think about a foreigner thinking about a South African bond investment, he's really got to worry about two main risks. The one is default risk, i.e. that he will not get his capital back. And the second one is almost the currency risk or the risk that you have rampant inflation, which leads to currency weakness, and that almost eats into his return that he would have otherwise prospectively made on the South African bond. So he's got to worry about currency risk and default risk. Okay. Now, with regards to the latter of those, in terms of the currency risk that the investor faces, and this is exactly why my initial remarks about the credibility of the Reserve Bank are so relevant, because South Africa has got the South African Reserve Bank, the SARB, has got a demonstrated history, of being able to keep inflation, very, very well kept in kilter, right? Within the band, and it's been able to do this, without necessarily resorting to very, very aggressive, sort of hiking cycles in the past, right? So, the Reserve Bank enjoys a significant amount of credibility, and that is why the foreign investor can almost somewhat have take some solace in the fact that the central bank will do what is necessary to keep inflation in kilter, and in some sense then by extension to defend the currency. So currency risk is something that, you know, is fairly you know, not an outsized risk for a foreign investor, right? So, and then we get to default risk. So default risk is the issue of that will a foreign investor have the opinion that I'm simply not going to get my rands back at all, right? And we think that there's actually a very small historical precedent for sovereigns that have defaulted on bonds in their own currency, right? So most of, you know, if we were to look at, you know, smaller, more vulnerable emerging market locations that have defaulted on dollar bonds, therein is exactly the point. They've defaulted on dollar-denominated bonds because, simply speaking, if you run out of dollar reserves, you cannot pay, you know, coupons in dollars. But strictly speaking, then by that same extension, I mean, if you have, you know, sort of monetary sovereignty, in other words, if you can print your own currency, then in theory, the risk of then defaulting on a bond in rands, you know, shifts, very much out of view, because the central bank could always monetize the debt, right? And so I'm simply making the point that there is a very low historical precedent for countries defaulting on bonds in their own currency. So if you take the two things together, the fact that we have got a stockpile of credibility with regards to currency risk, and also if you can more or less shelve this idea that you won't get your rands back, then South Africa still does present a very, very compelling investment case, especially if you consider the idea that we've still got such high real yields on offer. So I don't think it's going to be the case where there will be a wholesale capitulation, of the foreign contingent with regards to South African bonds in totality, in the sense that we're very far off from the stage at which it will become almost like radioactive and untouchable, right? I think that the bonds certainly do enjoy still, this element of credibility and, you know, as I say, afforded by the Reserve Bank and other strong institutions. However, what I would also say is that the appetite of foreigners with regards to the South African bond market is not only a function of the idiosyncratically South African development here. In other words, it's not just about what is happening in South Africa, but also sort of like the global macro landscape also determines to a large extent whether foreigners will play in our markets or not. I'll give you a good example. At the moment, we know that because of the aggressive, policy stance in the U.S. in the past two and a half years, let's just call it, since, around March 2022, you've got this idea where risk-free rates in the U.S. have increased meaningfully, right? So because of this, I mean, the hurdle rate to actually investing in South African bonds when there's such a compelling deal on offer back home in the US, the case for high carry emerging market destinations has waned somewhat, right? So now you see that at the same time that there's a lot of noises being made about our deteriorating fiscus, at the same time you actually have quite a compelling and quite a high hurdle rate to beat before foreign capital will find our shores, right? So I don't think one can make too many inferences about the lack of interest on the part of foreigners for our South African bonds when you also have major sort of global macro headwinds like the elevated front end, the elevated risk-free rates that are on offer in the US. So it's a story once again also that remains to be seen. But I think that in answering that question, one needs to consider sort of the global context in totality.
Reza, one proposed solution to address government debt that you did not mention earlier is the implementation of prescribed assets, which is now an official fixture in the ruling party's manifesto. The ANC said in its manifesto that it will forge ahead with plans to revive this apartheid-era rule, compelling pension funds to plow money into certain government-approved investments, assuming it retains power in the upcoming elections. What are the chances of this playing out, and should local and foreign investors be worried, and how worried should they be?
Yeah, so I mean, I think with the data that's available, I think it's still too early, to hypothesize exactly how this actually plays out. But I mean, if we just think about the idea of prescribed acids, I mean, it's not, of course, a new concept in the sense that, I mean, there have been prescribed legislation that advocated prescribed acids, from the mid-50s. I mean, in those decades, the prescribed acids at that time were largely government bonds themselves and certain key parastatal organizations, right? I mean, and largely that legislation sort of fell by the wayside in the late 80s and early 90s. So it's not a completely foreign concept, but I mean, philosophically, the idea of having a prescribed asset, I mean, somewhat, there are largely two camps, I would say. I mean, those that, are largely almost against the idea of it usually would make the arguments that essentially, why does one need to have the term a prescribed asset? You know, in other words, it's almost suggesting that these assets, because they are prescribed, are assets that would not otherwise garner any interest on their investment merits alone. In other words, if they were not prescribed, no one would be interested in them at all. So why would we then want capital to be attracted to such assets that would not otherwise garner any interest? I mean, so that is one common critique of this idea of prescribed assets. But and then there's also the other the guys sort of in the other camp who are more sort of supportive of these measures would argue from a more developmental angle that the kind of projects and assets that will be prescribed, you know, speak to the broader structural reforms that South Africa need to basically address. Like, for example, again, eye-watering unemployment and very, very weak capital formation, and for example, grassroots skills transfer and many of these other sort of structural impediments. They argue that, you know, if we just let, you know, free sort of capitalist markets, you know, have their sway, then these developmental imperatives will never get lift off, right? So again, it's sort of a multifaceted consideration plate. I mean, and the idea also, you know, about prescribed assets is that, remember, it's all good and well to speak of these assets. I mean, but what happens when you sort of run out of pipeline? Remember, as soon as you start making it mandatory, for example, to invest in a particular utility or a particular parastatal, remember, there will be a massive influx of demand of structural capital that is flowing into that security simply because it's now been prescribed. So with limited supply and almost an engineered level of demand, what's going to happen is that the price of that asset is basically going to rise. It's going to go up. But higher starting prices and higher starting valuations is generally a recipe for low prospective returns, right? So the fact is that it's going to be high demand, low supply. High demand creates high entry prices, high cost of acquisition, and that lowers your prospective return. I mean, which are just basic finance tenets, right? So you are now going to have a situation where investors are almost forced and cornered to hold an asset by law, which by the very mechanics of the law itself is offering very meager prospective returns, which again doesn't sound like a very prudent allocation of capital, right? So that is just one other thing that one must sort of keep in mind with regards to perhaps the challenges around this somewhat thorny issue. But like I say, I think the data and the information that we have, to date, you know, it gives very, very little clarity on exactly how and exactly which instruments and which broad sectors this will actually take place in.
We've unfortunately run out of time. Thank you, Reeza, for your time and your insight into fixed income, bonds, and prescribed assets. And to all our CityWire South Africa listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money, Markets, and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uester. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We are available on both Spotify and Google Podcasts, and will soon be on Apple Podcasts as well. Until next time, goodbye.